It's a great pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you very much, Director General De Silva and Assistant Director Rene Castro, for welcoming Google here and giving us the opportunity to share our experiences with you. Something funny, I think people are curious about how FAO and Google, which seem like such different institutions, could manage to create a partnership. And I even saw a rumor that FAO and Google were planning to merge. So, Director General, we need to decide, are we going to call it Fugle or Gao? So my team and I are very happy to be here with you. We would like to share a little bit about our more than 10 years of working at Google on Google Earth Outreach, using digital mapping tools for the good of people and the planet. Our group is actually known as Geo for Good within Google. A little bit about the beginning. Many of you know Google Earth. As Director General said, it's a popular recreational tool. Many people know Google Maps. More than a billion people use Google Maps. Maybe some of you used it to get here today and you're not lost, so that's good. But there were some surprising things from the very, very beginning of Google Earth and Google Maps that went beyond recreation, went beyond navigation, that opened the eyes of the executives at Google. And the first example happened literally the first day that I joined Google. Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. It was a terrible situation. Levees were bursting. There was flooding throughout the city. People were stranded on the roofs of their homes. They were calling for help. The first responders were coming in from around the country. They did not know the area. They were having a hard time figuring out how to effect rescues. Meanwhile, the U.S. government was flying and collecting aerial imagery, high resolution, fresh, every hour, aerial imagery of the city. But they didn't have a way to publish it. They didn't have a way to put that in the hands of the first responders. Meanwhile, Google Earth had just come out 2 months earlier. This was August 2005. And they said, would you help us publish this fresh imagery and put that in the hands of the first responders? So I was very proud to see the team worked around the clock to do this. And I'll show you what it looked like.
Hi, my name is Captain David Staggard, and I'm with the U.S. Air Force, and I'm deployed to Mississippi right now, supporting Hurricane Katrina.
This is before the flooding, and you'll see it switch
to
the flooding imagery.
Your Google Earth software that we were using, actually people are calling in request to us to have us go down with helicopters and rescue them, and we were using your software to put their addresses in, and then we were going down and rescuing them and saving their lives. Today we've saved over 4,200 lives, and I think this is an amazing opportunity for you guys to showcase your software and your company, and to show how you guys are working and how we're using your software.
So that was the first really humanitarian use of Google Earth. Meanwhile, at the same time, in a personal story, I live in the Santa Cruz Mountains in Northern California, and at the same time, I got this notice in the mail. Several thousand of my neighbors and I got this notice, a notice of intent to harvest timber. This is an area with some of the largest old-growth redwoods left in Santa Clara County. And my neighbors and I were concerned about what this map was trying to say. No one could understand it. And I challenge even the FAO mapping experts in this room, could you read this map and tell me what it says? And so many of my neighbors just threw it out because we couldn't understand it. But Google Earth had just come out, and I thought, I wonder if I could study this map, extract the plan, put it in the high-resolution 3D imagery of Google Earth, and would we have a better picture of what was being proposed? Maybe it wasn't anything to worry about, or maybe it was. But this was not helping us understand. And so over a weekend, I did that. I brought the proposal into Google Earth. And through doing that, we were able to create a much better understanding of the problems, the issues, the risks of the plan. The newspapers began to pick it up because I was being asked to present it all over to politicians, to the media, and so forth. And they picked up this idea of sort of democratizing access to satellite imagery for this type of public participation. And ultimately, we used Google Earth to show that the plan was illegal, and we stopped the logging. The word of that victory, using Google Earth to save the redwoods, spread, and I began to be contacted by the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, WWF, different organizations who said, would you teach us how you used Google Earth as a tool for educational awareness, for advocacy, for communicating with the government? And that led to the start of what we call Google Earth Outreach, which is a program for fostering the use of our mapping tools, Google's mapping tools, to make the world a better place. And if you go to earth.google.com/outreach, and it's in a number of different languages, you can see tools and resources that we make available for these types of special applications. So a little bit more about Earth Outreach. We work with nonprofits, scientists, educators, journalists, government agencies, focused on how to leverage the power of these tools and data for many public benefit applications. And we do trainings and workshops. We did one here yesterday. And we provide a lot of online resources. Since we launched Earth Outreach, there are more than 6,000 nonprofits around the world that have been successfully using these tools as a way to, again, raise awareness and actually impact public policy on important issues. The Halo Trust is using Google Earth to remove undetonated landmines, unexploded ordnance, in some of the most war-torn regions of the planet after war is over. There are situations where children cannot walk to school across a field without fear of their legs being blown off. And the Halo Trust is using Google Earth and the high-resolution imagery as an operational tool for planning the eradication of these landmines. For example, in Afghanistan, here is a green area. It was already cleared of mines. A red area is where they're planning to remove mines. This is an area before landmine removal, and in the satellite imagery, you can see that no one lives there. It's too dangerous. This is 2002. And in 2011, after they've completed the removal, you can now see that people have returned and the land can be used again. So in addition to supporting a series of nonprofits, our team also gets involved in a few key initiatives, and you'll hear about some of them today from David Thau and Brian Sullivan, where we spend a great deal of time ourselves in that area to help advance the success of those projects and partnerships. I won't go through all of these, but you can sort of skim and see a representative set. One that I'll mention is our Indigenous Mapping, Cultural Mapping Program. Chief Almir Surui of the Brazilian Amazon came to Google headquarters in 2007 and said that his land was being invaded and they needed help. He had stumbled on Google Earth in an internet cafe. And like everyone else, he flew to his home, and you can see his territory is this beautiful virgin rainforest, but surrounded at its borders by stark clear-cutting. And in fact, in the imagery in Google Earth, he could even see areas that were being invaded that he was not aware of. And he decided that Google Earth could be a tool for defending their territory, and actually even for creating sustainable development plans for his community. He asked us, and by the way, this is what it looks like at the border. He asked us to come and train them on the use of Google's mapping tools, both for cultural mapping, capturing traditional knowledge, but also for vigilance, and using Google Android smartphones to monitor and defend their territory. People were skeptical. They said, can you even teach Amazon indigenous people how to use the internet, how to use smartphones. Some of them walked for 2 days through the rainforest and had never touched a computer before or seen a smartphone. But within a few hours, they were navigating their way with these easy-to-use tools and making great progress. So one great outcome is they created this cultural map, which is online and available to everyone. They also did a carbon mapping of their forest using these digital tools. And a great success story, they've become the first indigenous tribe to successfully create a forest carbon offset program and sold 120,000 tons of carbon offsets to Natura, the largest Brazilian cosmetics company. It's really changed their existence. And now, in partnership with the Brazilian government and USAID and NGOs in Brazil, we've been asked to expand this to 30 additional communities. And that work is underway right now. So are we done? No, because, for example, the world is changing, as you all know, in dramatic ways observable from space. This is viewing deforestation of the Amazon over 2 decades. We were approached by Brazilian scientists who said, we don't just want to look at this imagery in Google Earth and Google Maps. We want to analyze the change. We're losing 1 million acres of rainforest in the Amazon every year. Much of it is happening in remote parts of the forest where there's not good law enforcement on the ground. But with daily satellite imagery and the ability to analyze that, to do science on it, we could detect automatically where change is happening and have a virtual alerting system. They knew how to do this, but the challenge was it was terabytes of data. When they would try to do this analysis on a single computer, it would take weeks, and by then it was too late. And he said, Google, would you let us actually use your massive computing infrastructure to do environmental analysis and change detection? So that led to, and by the way, a lesson. Be careful what you ask us to do, because we might actually do it. That request from a Brazilian geoscientist led to our starting the Google Earth Engine project, which is about deriving information about a changing planet. There's such a wealth of fantastic data that is being collected right now by dozens and dozens of satellites that are working very hard right now. An example is the Landsat mission, 40 plus years of systematically observing the Earth, collecting great imagery of every spot every 16 days. The problem is that data tends to come off the satellites and in this case go into or onto tapes in a vault in South Dakota. So the data is very secure, that's good, but it's not very accessible for actually doing science analysis and so on. And so as part, one of the first things we did with Google Earth Engine was to take 40 years of that data off tape and set up feeds of fresh data as it's coming in from many of these satellites and put it all online in the Google Cloud with co-located with computers for doing the scientific processing. When you do that, when you have all the data, you can take images like this. This is a pretty typical image in the tropics. Often there's clouds, and it's difficult for scientists to work with. But because many images are collected of that same place over time, you can sift through those pixels and produce a composite image that looks like that. I believe this is in... this is the Isle of Mull in England. We decided to apply this to Google Earth and Google Maps' own satellite imagery base map. This is what it used to look like before we did the Earth Engine analysis to produce what now looks like this. A beautiful cloud-free image of the entire planet, as if it's spring everywhere. We also then said, well, we have this 40 years of data. How can we help visualize the changing planet and put that in everyone's hands? We did a project with Time Magazine called Time Lapse. This is available Earth engine.google.com/timelapse, you can go anywhere in the world and you can see 3 decades of planetary change. Some of it's quite striking. Glaciers receding, irrigation in the desert, the creation of the Palm Islands off Dubai, deforestation of the Amazon. This is Las Vegas, the fastest growing city in the US through this period. Notice that while Las Vegas is growing, Lake Mead is shrinking. Again, the idea, the power of these visualizations in a few seconds to grasp issues of sustainability. And to give you a perspective on what was involved with that, we call this, you know, people talk about big data. Some of the biggest data that exists is this big data from space. This was 3 decades, more than 2 million satellite images we analyzed to produce time-lapse, almost a petabyte of data, a billion megabytes of data. It took more than 2 million hours of computation to produce that, but because we ran it on 66,000 computers in parallel, we had the result in a couple of days. On a single computer, that would have taken 300 years. So once we'd built that, and by the way, this was when my boss, who is the vice president for Google Earth and Maps, when he's like, I'm beginning to think you've actually built something useful now. But really, the reason we built it goes back to that Brazilian geoscientist. We built it to do science. And since that time, and you're going to hear shortly from David Thau on my team, about the many partnerships we've built with more than 10,000 scientific institutions around the world to apply this technology for areas of forest monitoring, water resource mapping, public health, and so on. And the key point here is it's these partnerships that bring our technology to life and to use. We at Google are very proud of our ability to manage big data, do this type of computation, create easy-to-use types of tools like Google Earth, but we are not the experts in sustainable forest management, in mitigating hunger, in governance, in the advanced science of these types of deriving information. And so these partnerships are critical. That's why we're very excited to be here today and to have kicked off this partnership in December with UNFAO. It is a very challenging time in the history of our planet. No one type of institution is going to solve the problems we face with climate change, with sustainable development. And yet, I think what's exciting is to see all of the partnership of FAO and Google. We can bring our unique strengths together, create this common vision, and really make a difference for the future of the planet and our future generations. So with that, I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. David Thau on my team, who's going to go into more detail about these applications of Google Earth Engine. Thank you so much.
It's an honor to be here. Rebecca told you a little bit about Earth Engine and what it does. What I'm going to do is tell you about some of the things that people have been building using the system. We really built it for other people to use, people who have the knowledge, and I'll give you some examples of what people are doing. The first area I'll focus on is forest. After the time-lapse project came out, one of the first works that an external partner did was a forest map. This is Dr. Matt Hansen, who's at the University of Maryland now. He used Earth Engine to go through the Landsat catalog, this catalog of 40 years worth of data, and created a high-resolution map of all the forests in the world. When he published the paper, he put up a website, which is accessible here, and you can go any place on the Earth and see how forest has changed over the span of the course of the study, which was at the time 12 years, and now has been expanded to the current time. You can see when forest loss occurred, where forest gain occurred, and where both loss and gain have happened, which is a sign of forest management. This was another big run, similar to what time-lapse was. It took 1 million hours of computation. That's decades of work if you did it on one computer or sitting under your desk. But because we were able to spread it out over many, many computers, it took only about 4 days. which is good because, you know, it wasn't perfect the first time, right? So you run it over the entire planet, and then, oh, this, you know, Indonesia's not quite right. Do it again. Okay, 4 days later, it's not so long to wait. Good thing. The science paper that was published from this has now been cited almost 1,000 times. The data set has been used in many, many different applications. One of the applications that we're really excited about is Global Forest Watch. This was a site that was organized by a nonprofit organization called the World Resources Institute. And what they did was they took the Matt Hansen data and lots of other data sets from various other scientists, brought them together and put them in an interface that was designed for policymakers and decision makers to be able to look at the data in a way that they could act on easily. This site kind of stands alone. It calls Earth Engine behind the scenes. You can go to an area that you're interested in, zoom in, so this is Sumatra, and circle an area in there, and do a quick analysis of how much forest gain happened, how much forest loss happened, and other statistics. This tool behind the scenes, it's sending a call to the Google servers, but you don't know what's happening. The answer comes back really quickly. And this tool is now being used broadly by lots of governments and lots of nonprofit organizations to help make decisions about forest management. So, for instance, the House of Representatives in the Philippines referred to the site and the data in it when discussing laws about mangrove preservation, and the bill that they were discussing passed because of it. And recently, a number of universities and nonprofits have used the system to monitor the habitats of tigers to see whether the international desire to double the wild tiger population by 2022 is possible. And as a result of their analysis, they determined that, yes, it was, because of the great ability of the governments to protect the tiger habitats. So these were forest applications. That was the initial place where people were using Earth Engine. But now it's branching out to lots of other areas, and I'm going to describe those. I think they're ones that you'll be very interested in. The first application I'll talk about is related to biodiversity. There is a site called the Map of Life. Map of Life has a number of species habitat ranges for many, many species. These are habitat ranges that were created using traditional modeling software, but they're not very precise. And so what the Map of Life site does is they use the data in our infrastructure to refine these maps. So if you take this area of a sort of a bird and you use additional data, you can refine the species range. And the idea is that by doing so, you can better target conservation efforts. The nice thing about this site and the efforts of the Map of Life is that they're deriving a number of indices, including for each species how much of their habitat is protected. And these indices are now being used in international treaties. So IPBES, which is a scientific body that reports to FAO, is using the indicators as a measure of biodiversity health. And it's also referred to by the CBD, the Convention on Biodiversity, in some of their indicators. So it's a good example of using the infrastructure, from another group using the infrastructure to come up with these indices that are being used globally. Our partners are doing a number of things on water issues. So the first one I'll talk about is work from the European Commission Joint Research Center on surface water availability. The planet is increasingly water stressed. It's hard to know exactly where the surface water is at any time. If you look at satellite imagery, sometimes it's obvious. So kind of in the middle of the Nigeria scene, it's clear where water is. But other times, it's not so obvious. And if you want to get a sense for where water is available and when water is available on a global scale, it's quite difficult. But the Joint Research Center has come up with methods to detect water from satellite data. So, for instance, their method determines that there's water in these areas, and they're able to look through this 4 years of data and come up with where water historically is and when it's there. And by analyzing the entire set of data, you can come up with maps like this one, where you see in the dark blue where water is permanent, and as it gets closer to the white, where it's more transitory. And you can do this as more data are collected, so we can have a constantly updating map of water availability on the planet. That's water. That's where the water is. Sometimes there's more water than we want, so there's a number of efforts around flood detection. The Landsat satellites that Rebecca talked about are optical. They kind of use cameras to take pictures, but sometimes that's not enough. If you're trying to detect where flooding is happening due to storms, you got a problem because usually storms come with clouds, and clouds you can't see through from space. So you need other kinds of information, and there are radar satellites that are collecting information now. And these radar satellites are now being used to detect floods due to storms. So for example, in Pakistan, there's a disaster monitoring system that they have, and they've been using this radar data inside Earth Engine to monitor flooding happening in Pakistan. So here you can see in the light blue where the river normally is, and in the darker blue where the flooding has occurred. And they say that they were able to, because they were using the system, get access to the data much more quickly and disseminate it much more quickly than they would have ordinarily had they had to download all the data themselves. So this is a good example of using radar data. There are other flood risk analyses. This is more climate change related. This is NGIS in Australia using the system to monitor flooding due to sea level rise. They've created a site that lets you kind of see how much damage is caused by different amounts of sea level rise. So on the left-hand side, you see there's a scale that shows if the sea level rises just under 2 meters, this is Vanuatu, how much damage is caused. And on the right-hand side, you can see their description of how much damage to buildings is due to this sea level rise. And you can increase, you know, if sea level rises more inundation. They use high-resolution elevation data to come up with these models. And the data is fine enough that you can see actually where, as the inundation happens, what areas are not flooded. And so this site was recently acknowledged by the UNFCCC as a lighthouse example of using technology to help mitigate climate change. All right, so those are examples of maybe too much water. There's an example of not enough water. There's a group, Justin Huntington and his colleagues are working on using the system for drought monitoring. They calculate the Palmer Drought Index on very large scale to see where there's anomalous drying and anomalous moisture. And you can sort of animate this over time to see the changes over time of drying and precipitation. And this kind of analysis is being incorporated now into the famine early warning system. This is ongoing work now. So I'm going to shift to another area. This is agriculture. So there are a number of people who are using this system that we're talking about to monitor agriculture in various ways. One way is evaporation monitoring. So the University of Idaho, Lincoln, Nebraska, and the Desert Research Institute are monitoring evaporation using satellite data. So you can look in an area here in the Midwest, the United States. You can check out some farms here. And by looking at weather data, slope data, lots of other data sets, estimate how much evaporation is happening in these farms. So here, the darker green is more evaporation, the lighter green is less evaporation. And this is being used by a number of organizations to monitor their crop health and how their irrigation is doing, and actually even to monitor where breaks in their irrigation systems are occurring. So here's an example of running the analysis on a vineyard in California. One more example of an agriculture application is rice paddy mapping. This is a number of people, universities, who are using the system and lots of different kinds of data to estimate where rice paddies are. So this is the first high-resolution map of where all the rice paddies are in South Asia. Here are the maps they came up with. The interesting thing about this study is they use data from European satellites, American satellites, Japanese satellites, and a number of other data sets all combined to do this very, very large scale, fine resolution mapping of where rice paddies are. And the last application in the agricultural space I'll tell you about is some crop yield monitoring done by David Lobel and Miha Jain and their team. What they do is they simulate crop indices, and they correlate that with satellite data. And then they use those correlations to estimate crop yield much larger scale. So here you can see an area in the Midwest. And red is areas of higher crop yield, blue is lower crop yield. And this is very high resolution data, and they're getting quite good correlations with actually self-reporting by the farmers. And you can use this to measure how the crops are changing over time. So again, here red is high yield and blue is low yield. And you can kind of see over time how the fields are changing. And now they're applying this outside of the U.S., and they're initially applying this in the Indo-Gangetic plain. This is an area sort of north of India and neighboring countries. And this map here is a map of crop yield averaged over 15 years for this whole area, where blue is low yield, and as you approach lighter colors, it becomes high yield. And you can zoom in and see the high-resolution data and look at where there are farms that have lower yield relative to their neighbors or higher yield relative to their neighbors. And they're currently working with the Indian government on a number of projects to see where they can increase yields for farms that are having lower yields than their neighbors. So hopefully that gives you a sense of some of the applications that people are doing using this technology and some that I think really matter to folks in this room. All of the examples that I showed are things that people using our system, the people who had the knowledge and the expertise to actually do the analyses correctly. And that's the strength of what we're doing. This is why we like working with partners like FAO. We're building a technology. It's a useful technology, and we're happy with the way it's going. But it's not useful unless people who know what they're doing are actually using it and making sure that the information is correct. So we're very happy and proud of this partnership. So now I'm going to turn it over to Brian Sullivan. He's going to go into some details about two other applications. Thank you very much.
So there's two examples that I want to talk through. And in many of the examples that Thao spoke to, this was us making our technology available to other organizations that have done incredible things. In some cases, we've worked closely with them. In other cases, we gave them the tools and we didn't even know how great the work was until they told about it afterwards. So the two examples I'm going to walk you through now are ones that our team sees as very strategic. So we're investing more time on the Google side to ensure that these projects move forward. And the theme is the idea that how can we empower other countries with new data, but more importantly, information and intelligence, so they can make better decisions for their own people and their own resources. And the first one I'm going to walk you through is for malaria risk mapping. Now, one of the reasons I love working with FAO is you guys take on massive issues. You say, we will eliminate hunger. And so when we get excited about something like malaria, we're working with partners that are saying, in these 8 countries in Africa, our goal is to eliminate malaria. It's not to decrease it, it's to eliminate it. And the reason elimination is important is in many of these countries, these diseases are very cyclical. And so when the burden is high, there's a lot of outside aid that comes in, and we know how to deal with that, and that gets that burden significantly lower. But when the burden appears to be low, all the outside funding and work dries up. And we're fine for a year or two, but then there is a boom of mosquitoes again, and malaria takes over. And it starts as a public health piece, but then we're affecting livelihoods, then we're affecting the economy, then we're affecting other areas of stability. So the goal is to eliminate it. But the process of elimination is very different than the process of decreasing it. And so new technologies and new processes are needed. So I want to tell you a story in Swaziland. Now, I've given this presentation many times. Depending on who I present this to, I sometimes have to tell them where Swaziland is. The beauty of FAO is you guys know these things. So I was here in February, and we're working with Swaziland's National Malaria Control Program. And this is them going out in rural areas, and you see they have the cool malaria surveillance t-shirt. And they'll go out where there's been a reported case study, and they will take blood samples, and they will look at other houses in the area, and they will survey that area to know how big is this spread, and what should we do in that case? Because identifying where it is very important. Now, they have two main methods of treating this. One is they come around and they spray the area with insecticides, and that kills the mosquito in the houses. Of course, you have to know which houses are important to spray. Insecticides are expensive, they're potentially bad for the environment, and it takes a lot of resources to go out and spray them. The other thing that's key is bed netting, also known as fishing nets in other regions, but I'll talk about that later. So the question is, how do we know where best to deploy these fishing nets? Now, what we need are high-resolution risk maps. Now, in some of these countries, we do have risk maps. The red area is where we have malaria. The white area is where we don't have malaria. That is the country of Swaziland there. So if you're trying to deploy your insecticides and your mosquito nets, where should you go? So working with UCSF, a public health institution in the United States, Gates Foundation, as well as countries, we've come up with a new approach through these partnerships. Now, the example I'm showing you is looking at the entire country at once. But just as David Thau showed that other work, we can zoom in and see these at a much higher resolution. So let's see how we could go about building a high-resolution risk map. Here's case data that the country is sharing of where we know there are cases of malaria. Next, let's look at typographic, or what's the elevation, because mosquitoes don't go above a certain elevation. Next, we'll bring in remote sensing data to look at basically a wetness index. How much rain do we get here? How much rivers are there? How much lakes are there? How damp is it? Mosquitoes, they breed where there's water. Now, using that data and machine learning, we can look at the risk on a month-by-month basis and see how that shifts with seasonal and environmental patterns. With that information, we can start to make additional decisions. Where is the population? Let's trim that population and then compare that to where we are currently deploying insecticides or mosquito nets. Based on that, where is the area that's currently at the highest risk? So here's a very high-resolution satellite imagery that we will put our model on top of, and you can see these are the areas we need to hit. This is at the block level within a village, because we don't need to cover the areas where people aren't sleeping at night, because that's when malaria is coming out. And with information like this, the government has a lot more details on how they can decide to deploy their limited resources to have the largest impact. Compare that map to the old map of the country. I want to talk about another project now. This is called Global Fishing Watch. We're doing it with two other organizations, SkyTruth and Oceana. A few facts on why we think fishing is important. Now, these facts come from FAO. And I will tell you that having presented multiple facts multiple times, it's a wonderful thing, because when I throw up slides and I say some data, they say, well, where did you get that data? And if I say it came from FAO, they say, oh, and Ben, and Ben. If I start saying, well, it's this long analysis, they want to see all the details. But when I say it comes from FAO, people are happy. So thank you for your work in that. So as many of you may know, about a billion people depend on fish as a primary source of protein. About 90% of the apex species, think tuna, think swordfish, have disappeared within our lifetime. So if you look at a room like this, and we say, just one generation ago, if this was the population of tuna, this is about what we have today. 85% of the world's fisheries are overfished, at capacity, or recovering. And about 1 in 5, or 20%, of the world's fish falls into a category that's called IUU, or illegal, unregulated, and undocumented. When we then look at the global trade of fish, it turns out about 38% of the fish that's caught locally is then traded internationally. That means that 55% of that is coming from developing countries, often the ones that don't have alternative food sources. And about $60 billion is the economic value of that export. So as in many other cases, it's the developing countries that are being hit the hardest by these economic demands. So the question is, you've seen it in numbers, but how can you visualize the impact of what global fishing is? So this is a photo in China. And I don't want to pick on China. This happens lots of places. But there's a three-month moratorium on fishing. That moratorium means that for 3 months, they're not going to fish. So if you're a fish, you have to go out, grow to maturity, and reproduce, because at the end of 3 months, this is what's coming for you. Now, these are all commercial, industrial fishing vessels. So you can count all these. Now, this is a tragedy of the commons, because the first one out gets the fish. So if you count all of them, we can zoom out a little bit. You get a sense of just how many fishing vessels are out there. Now, if any of you have counted that, we'll zoom out one more time. And you get a sense of what the global fishing fleet looks like in this one region of China. So how do we zoom out and see the entire world? Now, we have these photos because there's a photojournalist that's there and knows this event's happening. How can we see the entire world? So by analyzing billions and billions of ship position reports, we're creating something that within the first few seconds, you'll be able to understand. This is fishing effort. This is where, at a global level, fishing is happening by the world's largest fishing vessels. And depending on who you are, you will see something different in this. If you're an oceanographer, you'll see near the equator, there's that line where there doesn't look to be much fishing. And there's a subduction zone. So we have very warm waters. They're low in nutrients and low in life, so there's little fishing. But just to the left of that, we don't have a pointer. Oh, we do kind of have a pointer. This is 65% of the world's tuna. Now, if you're a policy person, you'll see these little blue lines. They're kind of hard to see here, but around every country, 200 nautical miles, that's an exclusive economic zone. Every country gets to decide who fishes in their waters. So you'll see lines around Latin America, and Chile and Peru. They're clearly demarcated. Inside that, Chilean fish, and outside that, international people are fishing. But people are not fishing in Chilean waters. If you compare that to West Africa, and that's we can zoom in on this in the live version, you'll see that those lines mean almost nothing, either because people, there's no monitoring or there's no enforcement, or in some cases, the country needs that money today, and so they're licensing the right to others. So look at what it looks like globally. And now we're going to dive into just three countries. And we're going to look at Spain in blue. We're going to look at Korea in green and Japan in red. And then the yellow is the mixture of the two of them. What we see is as we zoom out, just three nations have a global footprint that's very similar to all the world. Now what's exciting about this is it means if we can get some of the top nations to fish sustainably, then we can have a global impact. Now, the same way we're seeing things in a macro view where we see the entire world, we can zoom in to a particular area, we'll pan over, we'll click somewhere on there, and on this it's hard to see, but you'll see there's the track of an individual fishing vessel, the lines going back and forth, and those red dots around it are when other people are fishing. So our algorithms look at this track and decides where's they're fishing and where's they're not fishing. And if you look over on the side, you'll see that this vessel's called the Valmetal. It's a Portuguese longliner. And we're very excited because we've been talking with FAO and their vessel registry programs about how to incorporate your knowledge, because you have one of the largest collections of vessel registries in the world, and integrate that into Global Phishing Watch. A few more examples very briefly. Let's look out in the Pacific, in this region. We're going to zoom in a little bit more. Now, in this photo, remember all the red is where we think phishing's happening. There's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. What that means is something so special that we should protect it. So take a guess at where the World Heritage Site is. How many of you guessed that green box outside the main one? Now, when this happened, this was perfectly legal. However, President Tong, the president of Kiribati, whose waters this is, as of January 1st, 2015, said this will become a complete no-take zone. No fishing will be allowed. So in March of last year, we were asked to come and present at the United Nations when they were drafting their Sustainable Development Goals. Number 14 relates to the ocean. And so alongside a panel of scientists that said why it's important to protect at least 10% of the ocean so that fish can recuperate and spread, they were also asking the private industry and other nonprofits that said, how, if we create these marine protected areas, can we monitor them? It's very expensive. What tools are available? And so we thought Global Phishing Watch would be a great example. And so we presented this alongside the president of Palau, and this became part of the Sustainable Development Goals. So as we mentioned, President Tong would make this green area in here a complete no-take zone. Now, this is in the middle of the Pacific. It's very hard to monitor. So what we're able to show at the United Nations, would people clear out? And now we're going to look at this over time. And we see that the fishing effort in the Phoenix Island Protected Area does indeed clear out. And that shows that if you enact policy, it can be monitored. We then went to Kiribati at their request. And we showed them these tools so that they could use them to better monitor their own waters. And we also gave them a success story. Kiribati is 100,000 people spread over 3,000 miles and 30 atolls. About 65% of the country's GDP comes from the right of allowing other people to fish their waters because they don't have the capital to do that. Of course, if they're overfished, they'll lose that ability. So monitoring this is very important. And after we left, they said, we think we have the first case of suspected illegal fishing in Pipa. Can you help us? And they had brought a vessel in, and it takes them 3 or 4 days to get out there by boat. And they brought the vessel back, and the captain of the vessel denied fishing. And he said, you can take me to court. Based on the data you have, you can't prove I was fishing. I'm allowed to pass through. And we showed him something. Oh, there we go. So let's look at this live version where we get to watch his ship track. And it's a little hard to see in this projector, but you're going to watch him go up to Kiribati, and he's going to come through. Remember that this red area in here is where he's going to fish, so he's going back to port. Now he comes down. And right here, you can see that fishing activity in that. So we showed him this fishing activity, and we gave this to the government of Kiribati. I was no longer there. And they showed this to the captain. The captain looked at it, said, I'd like to move to settlement. And what's powerful about that is they got a $2.2 million fine. That's about 1% of the country's GDP before external aid. As exciting as that dollar figure is, what's far more exciting is that a local government has the ability to monitor these areas. And the other thing that's very exciting is the transparency of this, because this tool will be available for the entire world. Anyone with an internet connection will be able to use tools like this and see that. And them knowing that this will be made publicly available means that when there's somebody that might be a harbor master and he's offered a bribe of $50,000, which is 10 times his annual income, he's not in a position where he has to decide whether or not he could do that. Because knowing that this is public, it enables the country to address the corruption behind this, because investigative reporters and other people have access to this information and are able to have discussions about this. Moving along, we've also had Indonesia reach out to us. This is Ibu Susi, the head of fisheries and foreign affairs for Indonesia, probably one of the most progressive fisheries ministers out there. And she said, I love what Global Fishing Watch is doing, but I want it for Indonesia. And when we looked at the data, we said, unfortunately, our data in Indonesia is not very good. But you have the world's largest vessel tracking system that's proprietary. So if you're able to share that with us, we will give it back to you in the form of fishing effort. And she says, I am a leader in fishing. I want to make our data that was traditionally always closed public to the world. And we will do that through Global Fishing Watch. And with her making that statement, other countries have begun to come forward and said, we want what Indonesia has. And so this is something that years ago was completely unprecedented. Since then, the president of Indonesia came to Google, and we're working directly with their IUU task force to figure out how Indonesia can use this information to further their work. Of course, we have to show them Google Underwater Street View and a virtual reality experience. In addition to the visuals that we've shown you, just as FAO does, we're making this data available to researchers and other academics so that they can take this and push it towards policy, push it towards scientific research and other areas. And just like Earth Engine, the goal is to enable scientific, economic, and policy work that would not be possible without this underlying technology. But in all cases, we are simply providing access to this data and allowing others to make their own decisions and their own areas on that. So finally, we think this is kind of big. And we're really excited that we get to collaborate with FAO Fisheries on this. And when we've been talking with other people and they've seen this, often they say, are you working with FAO on this? Because they have some of the best vessel registries. And this is a huge fact that we think will really be a strong collaboration for the future. So thank you very much.
Here we are going to see a concrete example on what we have done inside FAO to build on top of the Google technology. So first I want to say that in our department, the forestry department, we start to think since some years that we should start to improve the way we were serving our member state, starting to build something, some applications, some tools which are totally open source, totally free, that could help country in improving their monitoring. But actually, some years ago, in particular at the end of 2008, we also met Rebecca in Brazil. We were both guests on a workshop of the Space Research Institute of Brazil, INPE, where she was there to presenting Google Earth. At that time, she was presenting the history function of the imagery in Google Earth while we were there discussing our traditional way to do remote sensing. They got the inspiration to build Earth Engine from that meeting in 2008. We got some other inspiration. I am super, super happy to say that after several years, we are now working together. The forestry department's kind of 2-3 years that is really cooperating and collaborating with them. And we now arrive to the level that we have built several tools. Today we are going to show one of these that is called Collect Earth, which is something that we say it's a tool that enables augmented visual interpretation all around the world. Why we say augmented visual interpretation and why we speak about visual interpretation? Visual interpretation of the very high resolution images, the images actually that where you can see exactly what is there, is the technique that is used by most European countries, US, Japan, and so on, to do their land assessment. This is the level that is done in the most advanced country. But each country has its system, and these systems are often very, very expensive. Now, thanks to this Google technology, thanks to our knowledge of this other system, we have built something which everywhere in the world can be used by any person, because we are speaking about something totally free, to do analysis, which I am proud to say this is even most advanced of what, for example, my country is doing today. I am Italian. We are doing in Italy just classical visual interpretation. We don't have the tool that Google Earth and Google Earth Engine offer us to analyze, for example, the spot that we are analyzing in this moment over time. If you look, I will show better in another images. So just to give an idea what we can do today, what you see here in a very high resolution images is in a spot. This was a natural land area in Somalia. If you are able to see the date on the top of this black box, actually on my screen, here is much better, you can see that here we are watching an images of 2002. But immediately, through Collect Earth, based on this Google technology, I can also have down what is the behavior of the vegetation during the last 15 years. So me, I am a forester, but I am not an expert at all in Somalia, and Somalia is not the most secure place where to go in these last years, unfortunately. But from these, I can see that in these images, I can see some green crown and some gray crown. So I start to say that, start to understand, okay, here there must be a combination of evergreen trees and deciduous trees. Then these images is telling me, okay, this is an image that was taken during the drought season. I can go through the history of this place with Google Earth freely everywhere in the world, and again I get another images in 2008, and again this is another drought season images. But please have a look now what's happened in 2009. 2009, we immediately understand that there was a huge impact there. There was some human disturbance, and in particular there was the clearance of the land with this square box. But from the vegetation index down there, I can see that actually even with this disturbance there is a presence of fresh vegetation, green vegetation. And immediately understand that this was an image taken during the wet season, where actually we could see all the vegetation, not only some plants, some trees, green. I can go forward and I can see that slowly human activity start. Here we have grazing activity, and then we turn in settlement, and in the vegetation you can see that the vegetation after 2010, at the end of 2010, de facto disappear in this zone, and now we are in the context of settlement area. So this can be done everywhere. This tool was mainly built to support country in their reporting, their land use assessment for Red Plus under the Climate Change Convention, but now is having a huge expansion. It's only 2 years that they are implementing this tool, but you can see from the map already where this has been used. And just to give you an idea, the next step that we are going to do is, first, this tool will be presented in 2 weeks' time in an IPCC meeting, where this will be presented as a solution, a methodological solution for country to report under the convention. But at the end of May, I have to say I am proud as FAO member to see a team of NASA coming here to be trained by us on how to use this tool based on Google technology. We have been among the first who understood that this Google technology could be a big technology advance, in particular for developing countries, because now we can do in Burkina Faso the same analysis that we can do at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And actually, if I may say, when we arrive in Burkina Faso, people are more open. They don't have to defend what they have done in the past. Sometimes we have more difficulties in making people understanding in the developed world what is the new frontier than what happened with the people in the south of the world. Then we will also do a training in the World Bank, and I just put a list of the country where we already planned to do the full assessment of the country in 2016. This tool enables us to go not only at the local or country scale, but also to realize assessment at the global level. So one of the efforts that we just completed is the first dry land assessment, where we will be able to report the assessment finish. We are elaborating the data. I would like to invite you, all of you, in 2-3 months to come back here, because we are going to show you different numbers about forested trees around the world, something that is going to be completely different from what we knew before. And just to give you an idea, this is what we were used to do before. This is an images with 30 meter resolution. So when I was a student, I was using these data. Today, thanks to the European, and these mainly are NASA, European, United States data. These are now the new data that are available through the European Space Agency satellite called Sentinel-2, which are all available through Google Earth Engine. And you start to see something, but these are the type of data that we work, which are globally available freely through Google Earth. And here is actually where you start to really understand what it is. This is the famous Baobab Street in Madagascar. But believe me, there will be never a scientist, never an expert, never even a computer who will tell you that this is the Baobab Street with this kind of data. You have to go there to see what it is. So, and this on top of this unbelievable new technology that is existing, that we build this tool collector that is enable country to go over the limit. But I want to finish here. We did collect that. We did other things in the forestry department, but we are not going to stop here. What Google has done is super revolutionary, but even Google people sometimes need help to understand how revolutionary is their technology. Look here. This is a photosphere, something that I collect with my smartphone, an Android smartphone, still Google. It's very simple. I was close to Rome with a delegation of forester people from Papua New Guinea. With my smartphone, I show them what you can do today. You may have 360 images. Look, I was in the center, but I have disappeared. They are even able to make disappear, which is the best way to document it, what is a forest stand. So now, for example, the forest people of Papua New Guinea are not going to take simple picture, but going to take photosphere to document it, what is exactly the plot that they are measuring. But Google has already the technology to transform these 360 images, which is already super impressive for us, in something which is going to be a 3D vector model. So which is going to tell us what is the volume, what is the biomass that is exactly there. So this tool, which will improve incredibly the amount of our capacity in measuring forest from the field, but it will also enable us to make a big step forward in measuring forest measuring the biomass, the carbon which is there, something that will revolutionary the forestry science that we knew until now. And give us 1 year, two maximum, and we will be there. And this tool will be freely available to all our country members all around the world. Thank you.
I want to show you just very briefly another example of how the organization FAO were using Google technology. And this is with desert locusts. Now, desert locusts can affect 20% of the land's Earth surface, of the planet. 10 years ago, we had a very small regional plague that just affected one portion of this area, and it took nearly $500 million to bring it under control. 2 years. 12 million liters of pesticide were sprayed. Now, the option to this is prevention. And prevention in that part of the world costs about $3 million a year. So if we just do the math, that's roughly about 200 years of preventive control that it took just to control that one small plague. During that period, 60% of the households in Mauritania went into debt just because of the locusts. A small locust swarm that covers the capital of Niger, Niamey, consumes the same amount of food in 1 day as half of the country. So after 2 days, it would have eaten all of the food that everybody in Niger would have eaten. So the potential here is dramatic. Swarms can move from one side of Africa, from east to west, in a couple of weeks. So we really don't want this to happen. It's kind of a bad thing. So FAO, since its beginning, since the organization was established 70 years ago, we've been operating an early warning system. And over the past 7 decades, this system has been improving. It's been evolving. It's been getting better. We're taking advantage of the latest technologies, Google being one of them.
But prevention relies on early warning and early response, early control. So to this effect, we've established a network. We have a network with about 24 of the frontline countries that must face desert locust infestations every year. They might be a low level, might be a high level. That can turn into an outbreak and eventually evolve into a plague. And there are another couple of dozen countries that can be invaded during plague periods. So there's 50-odd countries that are impacted here. Now, how does this system work? The frontline countries are out in the desert every day looking for locusts, looking for the green annual vegetation that occurs after the sporadic rainfall that falls in the desert, checking that vegetation to see if there's locust infestations, and if there are serious infestations, then they try to treat them. But this is a pretty hit-and-miss situation, to be honest. The desert is huge. How does a team in Sudan or Chad or Libya or Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, know where to go? It's not easy. They use new technologies that we've developed in the past couple of years that once they're in the middle of nowhere in the desert, they find important infestations or green vegetation, they can in real time transmit that data by satellite to their national locust centers. From there, it comes up to FAO headquarters here where we have a global view of the situation and we analyze that data, we provide early warning and forecasts. So that works quite well, getting the data now in real time. We know everywhere 5 minutes ago where the teams are globally and what they're finding. But still we have a basic problem. This is a typical patch of hoppers. Now, a single patch is not going to create a plague. Of course not. But hundreds or thousands of these, they will. They'll create an outbreak, and if that's not treated and controlled, the plague can occur. And then we're again faced with a situation where we need $500 million to bring it under control, spraying tens of millions of liters of pesticide. So the challenge is, how do we find this small patches here? It's like trying to find a brown paper clip in Rome. How do you do it? Yeah, we have remote sensing imagery. The countries are using remote sensing imagery to show where it's been raining, to show where there is green vegetation. But the problem is that this imagery is often late. Countries, they have to go to a website, they have to find it, they have to download it. Halfway through the downloading process, the energy, the power of the country shuts down or the office has no electricity and they have to start again tomorrow. Very frustrating kind of approach for these countries. After several times of this, they just get fed up. They don't use the remote sensing imagery. So this is how Google can help us. They have available 40 years of remote sensing imagery in one place, all different types of imagery. They're adding 4,000 images a day. It's available just through the internet, through a website. You don't need a custom application or anything. This puts in the hands of the countries, not just FAO here and headquarters, but in the countries, in our member countries, those countries that have to face desert locust infestations and plagues, it puts in the hands an amazing amount of information and an incredible tool that can help them to delimit those huge areas in the desert, where to look for green vegetation, where to look for locusts, into much smaller areas that they can prioritize and that they can send teams directly to it. Let me give you a few examples. This is northwestern Mauritania. There's a locust outbreak there currently there. And that's a huge area. I mean, and there's no towns, there's no roads, there's no infrastructure there. It's just flat desert. A couple plateaus, some sand dunes and stuff, but it's very difficult to know where to look for locusts. In this image that's available in Nouakchott at the National Locust Center, where they have to manage all the locusts and where they have to tell the survey teams to go, they easily go to that site, they look at the latest imagery, and they can see very clearly that, yes, there's some green vegetation here, these colored pixels, that those are the areas where they need to check, along the wadi here, along the edge of a plateau, and they can send their teams directly there. This is much more cost-effective. uses their limited resources in a much, much better way. Here's another example, Mali. Difficult place to operate these days. Central Mali, they have large areas of vegetation, but which areas are most important for desert locusts? It's those fresh areas where the vegetation, the annual vegetation is just sprouting, just becoming green. So how do I know which areas? Again, with Google Earth Engine, the National Locust Center in Bamako can identify those areas. In this case, it's these larger red areas. This is where vegetation was not green 1 week ago, but has just turned green. So send teams to there, and you have the highest probability of finding locusts and initiating any control operations early enough to prevent an outbreak and a plague from developing. So these are just two examples of how Google Earth Engine can help countries delimit these huge areas that they must search every day, every week, every month into higher probability and prioritized places. But there's more. Of course, there's always more. Another use of the Google Earth Engine and its technology is to allow countries to see the current situation in real time throughout all countries at a global level. Because as I mentioned, desert locust swarms, they can move fast. So country is always on edge. Will they be invaded? Will they not be invaded? What's going on in the neighboring country? What's going on in the other region? They can rely on FAO, of course. We provide the early warning, but they often have to wait for our products to come out. But here they have a tool in their hand that they can go into the office in the morning, start up, and they can say, oh, Mauritania can see that there's some locust infestations on the border with Algeria. If they know about the winds, then those infestations might move into Mauritania, and they can take the necessary actions. Another example that we're encouraging countries is to look at their own field survey data with all of this remote sensing imagery that's available from Google. So they can see the relationships of where their teams are, what they're finding to green vegetation, for example, or even to previous locust infestations or reports. So these are very powerful tools that are in the hands of the users in the National Locust Center, as long as they have a computer, an internet connection, some electricity, and a web browser. That's it. That's it. Now, as Danilo mentioned, yes, we're always looking to the future. We're not going to stop here. And the next challenge is, how can we put this technology that now is in the hands here at FAO and in the hands of the National Locust Centers into the hands of the people actually in the field, into the hands of the locust survey officers who are actually in the field trying to find this vegetation, trying to find these locusts? And these are areas where there's no internet connection. There's no electricity. There's no Wi-Fi. There's no GMS. There's nothing. And probably many of you have heard that Google has another project going on called Project Loon, providing internet through balloons. Well, we think that with the partnership with FAO and Google, we can make more inroads here and get this project to reach the areas that will help the desert locust countries. So this is just one example, one small step of how we're trying to use Google Earth technology to eradicate hunger and poverty. Thank you very much.